Everybody, once everybody's sitting down, as I used to say, once you're sitting comfortably, then we'll begin. Right, story time. So the title of this talk is, what did I sign up for?
What
was I signing up for? But I never follow the titles of the talks. Instead, you know, you give a talk about Buddhism, the Dharma, and how it relates to this life. But it is true that when I became a monk, I never ever thought I would be doing things like this, giving talks and having my photograph taken. I never thought that sometimes people would offer flowers to me, but it told me about the law of karma, because when I was a young man, I gave flowers to my girlfriends, and the karma from that means now that some people give flowers to me. But it is a great privilege to be able to serve. I know that one of my good friends is a Thai monk called Ajahn Gangha, and he's the monk in one of my books. I wrote about how he was in the jungle in Thailand, meditating with many monks, when a king cobra came up to him. Now this is not an exaggeration, this is a true story. King cobras in that part of Thailand had a nickname, the one-step snake. When I asked why they called him one-step snake, the answer was, if it bit you, you had one step left, and then you're dead. They were very venomous. So, this big king cobra came up to him, and all the monks saw it. And the king cobra lifted up its head, opened its hood, right at nose level, and hissed at his nose. Now, if such a big, venomous snake came up to you, what would you do? Don't think of running, because those snakes, I've seen them in the jungles of Thailand, they can move much faster than you can. That is amazing and terrifying to see how fast they can run through the jungle. You have no hope, they'll catch you. So what this monk did, no exaggeration, he lifted up his hand and patted the king cobra on the head, saying in Thai, "Thank you for coming to visit me." And do you think that king cobra bit that monk? Of course not. Big snakes like that really enjoy having a pat on their head. It's so rare to get those. Who wants to bite the hand that pats them? And all the monks saw that. So the king cobra, while patted on the head, and after he enjoyed being patted on the head, the cobra pulled in its hood, went down onto the ground, went to visit another monk, raised its head, opened its hood. Now the monk said, "No way, go back to that monk. I'm not patting a king cobra." But that was the monk who patted a king cobra. He became a good friend. He came to visit the monastery in Australia where I lived. And the very first year, when we were building up our monastery, and we were applying for the building permission and the planning permission to build our big meditation hall. You know what happened? The mayor of the local council came to see us on an official visit. He was wearing a suit, which Australian people very rarely wear. But he was the mayor. And the suit was buttoned up, and those poor buttons were almost popping out because, like many Australians, he had a very big belly. This is much bigger than I have, because I've only been living in Australia for 33 years. Give me a few more years. But anyway, if anybody worries about this, I honestly say this is not fact. It's something else. Because I've now been a monk, Desmond, 43 years. Every year that you practice as a monk, you increase in compassion and kindness. Every year your heart gets a bit bigger. Many years ago my heart got so big it pressed against my ribcage, could go no further, so it went down and out. This is not fat, this is a big heart. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. But it does have its advantage. I was at my temple in Perth once. It was Chinese New Year. I was just standing welcoming some guests. And of course you know what happens, Chinese tradition. Before I could stop here, an elderly Chinese lady saw me and rubbed my tummy for good luck. I never signed up for that. But I let her because it was like fun and kindness, compassion. But that was the monk, no, the one who patted the king cobra. Oh, that's right, when the mayor came with a big Australian belly, before I could stop this monk, he went up to that mayor and started rubbing his belly. You do not do that to mayors. And I thought, oh my goodness, we will never get permission to build our buildings anymore. But to my great surprise, I should have known better, this Thai monk who could speak no English, rubbing this fat mare's belly, that mare started to giggle and chuckle like a little baby. He loved every minute of having his fat belly rubbed by this Thai monk who could speak no English. And from that time on, we got every building permission we asked for. So if you have any trouble with the council, with renovations or buildings, just please go up to the mayor and rub his belly and see what happens. But he was a very wise, he was kind, compassionate. And that just is what came across. That, you know, these Buddhists were really kind, beautiful people who they could relate to. And so we became a very, very close friend and would always come up and make sure we were okay. But that monk, I went to see him a couple of years ago and he gave me some advice. He looked at me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're doing a good job teaching in many countries, but be careful, he said. If you stop teaching, he said, you will die. That's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to retire. I wanted to not have to travel overseas anymore. And just relax, retire. And what age do you have to be to retire in UK?
67.
67? Well, actually, that's next year. This is my last visit. I suppose I have to retire now. But, no! Is it 65?
Was.
Was, okay. Yeah. But anyway, Marx can't retire. And anyway, he told me if I did retire, I would die. That's interesting, wasn't it? He was saying, no, that one of the purposes of life is actually to serve and help and give to other people, which is really important. So, I never signed up for that. You know, I never thought I'd be going around teaching and doing all these interesting things. But, if you're serving and helping and making a difference, what a wonderful privilege that is. And also to be helping create a Buddhism which doesn't divide people. An example of that was, I'm very open to go to conferences and to seminars to put Buddhism in places it's never been before. For example, in 2015, I gave the keynote speech which was after the introduction by the president of this society, I gave the next speech to set the scene for this conference. It was in Daejeon in South Korea. It was the 2015 World Computer Congress, opened by a Buddhist monk who knows nothing about computers. And so I was, as they used to say in Star Trek, remember Star Trek? But I changed the word slightly to bold, not boldly go, to boldly go where no monk has been before, teaching at computer conferences. Because there you can take these beautiful teachings of Buddhism and actually apply it to places which have never been applied to before, with amazing effect. So when they asked me, what are you doing here? What is a monk doing at a computer conference, giving a keynote address? And one of the first things I told them was a little story about synergy. The story of the ice cream cone. Do you know where that came from? St. Louis World's Fair, almost 100 years ago now, they had many stalls. Somebody had the permission to sell ice cream. Another person in the stall right next to the ice cream stall had the franchise or the permission to sell waffles. And the two of them, being together over many days, many weeks, they got a friendship together, and so they decided to see how they could combine waffles with ice cream. They turned the waffle into a cone, put the ice cream on top, and that was the origin of the ice cream cone, which we have today. Two different ideas which would never come together except by chance. So I told the World Computer Conference, who knows what can come out of a Buddhist monk teaching computers? We don't know, but synergy will actually show us. But what I did tell them was Buddhism, especially with the insight practices, show a lot about how we can have innovation. And this was the example which I told them. Actually, can I borrow your water bottle there? No, it's okay. I don't need water, it's just as a visual aid. I had a bottle of water next to me. You know what this is? It's Evian water. You know what Evian means? It's naive, spelled backwards.
You've been caught.
But anyway, I held up a water bottle, and I said, and I'm going to do the same exercise with you here. What is this I'm holding up? Come on, what is it? What else is it? That's it, what else?
Container,
what else?
Bridge.
What else? Keep on telling me what it is. I can stop now. Because the longer you look, the more you see. At the beginning, if I held this up, you say it was a water bottle. That's what you've been taught, but it's much more than that. The longer you look, the more you see. Until you get to a time, a point, where you've run out of the labels, what you've been told it was. And then you can start to see afresh, anew, some other uses. For what I'm holding up here. This is what innovation means. Innovation, you don't just look at something and just think, a water bottle, and then go on to something else. You look at it, stay with it, explore it, until you see things in this bottle of water you haven't been told, things which are new. Innovation. And they really got off on that. Because that is actually how we make breakthroughs, in industry. We make breakthroughs even in Buddhism. Yes, do you know what Buddhism is? Keep looking. See if you can see deeper. See if you can see more than you've been told. One of my sayings is, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. The learning will take you so far. Be still and go deeper. See what else is there. So that's why, yeah, that was cool, that a Buddhist monk was teaching people how to innovate. But I do even more interesting, you know, things than that, going to other conferences around the world, because in those conferences, that is also where you can take Buddhism to a wider level, but also allow yourself to be challenged. Because monks and nuns can be lazy. In other words, not lazy not working hard, but by lazy with their thinking and their ideas. It's great always to open yourself up to be challenged. So on this occasion, I was presenting at a conference in one of the Australian universities on chaplaincy, which is an important part for religion and spirituality, so we can help one another. So I was co-presenting with a good friend who was the abbot of our local Benedictine monastery, a man called Abbot Placid. I made a point of making friendships with him simply because it was the only two monasteries in that area and we're very isolated. And if I wanted to talk about abbot business, he was the one I went to. Because it's amazing. We're both spiritual communities. And amazing just how much experience and practical knowledge we can share. He became a good friend. You know, he had a character like me, you know, playful, joking. Because I remember he took me around a tour of his old monastery. It was the oldest building in Western Australia. And as he took me around his ancient buildings, I asked him, are there any ghosts in this monastery? And he said, in Catholicism we don't believe in ghosts. And then I told him, what about the Holy Ghost? That's our relationship. We teased each other. So, when we were presenting at this conference, there was this intellectual who was a Jesuit called Father Frank Brennan. If you aren't Australian, you may not know this fellow, but he is highly regarded, so much so that the then Prime Minister of Australia, I think it was John Howard, selected him to lead a panel to have a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. So this wasn't a lightweight. So when, at our presentation, he raised his hand to ask a question, I knew it was no time for one of my jokes. This was serious. So he asked an interesting question, now, which maybe you've been asked before as a Buddhist, by some of your non-Buddhist friends. What is the Buddhist idea of God? Now, you could be safe, follow the books and say, Buddhists don't believe in God. But that wouldn't have got you anywhere. So instead, I turned to my friend, Abbot Placid, with whom we'd had many, many deep conversations over the years of friendship. And I said, my friend Abbot Placid very frequently tells me that one of his basic beliefs is that everyone is searching for God. Now, I'm not going to reject that. The first impressions are, that's rubbish, we're Buddhists. No, I respect what he's saying. So, what do Buddhists search for? What are you searching for here? What do atheists search for? You search for respect? You search to love someone and to be loved? Searching for truth? For peace? For harmony? For health? what are you searching for in life? And I said, I know many Buddhists, atheists, people of many different philosophies and faith. Those are the things which people are searching for. Meaning, kindness. And I say love, the ability to love others and be loved. So if that's what Buddhists are searching for, and atheists too, and everyone is searching for God, that must be what God means to a Buddhist. Respect, love, and the ability to be loved, peace, truth, friendship, harmony. So, that's my answer to him. And he said he was quite impressed with that, for a couple of reasons. Number one, it takes a question deeper. He said, well, we don't believe in this. And it also breaks down barriers between peoples. Between people of different ideas and different upbringings. Do it so that it can solve the separations which people feel. We may add a few more things to that. But that's why I never signed up for that, but I love doing such things. Because I gain deeper wisdom and more ability to teach with kindness and bring people together. Instead of everybody always arguing and fighting wars together. And I think we were asked today about, you know, where we belong. And for me, it's very confusing. For me, I'm coming back here to the London Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square. And honestly, you know, I feel home. And the same when I went to the London Buddhist Vihara in Chiswick. That's my area where I used to have my girlfriends and mess around, school just down the road. It's home. But you know that I was so many years in Thailand. And especially going up to the northeast. And you know that area. That's where, you know, you have so many beautiful memories. That's my home. And then you go back to Australia. You know, that's where I've been living for the last I don't know how many years, and all my monks are there, nuns. They're your friends, that's your family, your home. And then I go to Singapore, where I've got lots and lots of followers there. And soon I go to Singapore, they say, welcome home, Ajahn. And then I go to Malaysia. There's lots of Buddhists there. And they respect me so much. I was at a conference. You know who I was representing? Really weird. Singapore, at this international conference. That was weird, wasn't it? Not for me. But anyway, I was passing the big steps of the conference hall, and the Malaysian delegation had the huge flag. And they saw me passing by, they said, Ajahn Brahm, over here. They said, well, I'm not Malaysian. Yes, you are, come over here. So I had my photograph taken in the official Malaysian delegation. I thought it was really cool. And then I go to Indonesia. In Indonesia, I've got a big group of followers. But that's really weird. Because you know what happened once, Desmond? I was travelling from Perth over to Indonesia to give some talks, and I'm travelling to Bali on Garuda Airlines. I usually like Garuda Airlines to go to Indonesia, but you know, once the flight was totally cancelled, I turned up at the airport, and the flight was totally cancelled for the day. And now I had to sort of get a telephone and call my host over there, I'm not arriving today. He said, why? What happened? Well, I said, I don't really know, but I reckon. Because that was the time they had bird flu over in Indonesia. And I said, well, Garuda's a bird. Maybe the plane's got bird flu. But another time, I was flying over there and the plane actually did take off. And this is one of the problems, as you say, being well known. Because I was sitting in my seat, minding my business, and this flight attendant came past and looked at me and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? And said, well, the last time I checked, I was. And she put her hand on her heart, this beautiful young flight attendant, and she gushed, oh, Ajahn Brahm, I must be your most adoring fan. And I thought, I'm going to get good service today. And I did. Anything I wanted. And then in the middle of the flight, after they've given the food, they call me over. Would you mind coming to the galley in the back of the plane? I didn't know what I was up for. But you know what happened at the back of the plane? Every one of the flight attendants was lined up. Photo op. But the trouble is, it took so long taking photos that all these Australians who were going to Bali on holiday were ringing their bells wanting a refill of beer. And they were told, wait until we finished our photographs with this monk. So when I went back to my seat, I got a lot of interesting comments from the Australians. So I had to wait for their beers. So anyway, even there, these are my friends. I've known these people a long time. So I don't know where I belong now. Isn't it wonderful that in this modern world, you know, we don't really associate, you know, with even where we were born. We're wonderfully mixed up human beings, where we will never fight, we should never fight over national boundaries, but instead, the only place we fight is on the soccer pitch or on the cricket oval. That's only because sometimes there's a cricket match between the Ashes, England and Australia, and sometimes people ask me who I support. And I always say I wait for the lunch interval to see who's winning, and I support them. Well, it's wonderful that just when you can actually break down barriers and be with people. And so also, you know, break down barriers because, as you know, background in theoretical physics. I'm trying to get that combination of physics and Buddhism together. I don't know if you... You know, you should invite this fellow over to give a talk at the Buddhist Society. I think I think his name before, Bernard Carr.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, did you ever get him to come here?
No, it's a good idea.
Yeah, because Bernard, Professor Bernard J. Carr, was the very first Buddhist I ever met. And the reason was, you know, I wasn't smart enough to find the Buddhist Society when I was at school. But when I went to Cambridge University, they have something called the Freshers' Fair. Society's Fair, they called it, in the Coin Exchange. So all the different clubs and societies had their stall to, you know, attract the students to their clubs. And when I walked in there, I saw Buddhist Society of Cambridge. And it was like, yes, there are other Buddhists in this world. I felt so alone. As a student, I didn't know any other Buddhists at all. I should have looked in the telephone directory, Buddhist Society of London, but I never did. And so I went up to the store, and there was this young student there, and I said, I want to join. And as Buddhists, you say, you don't have to. Come and see first of all. I said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I want to join. No, he said, come for a few talks first of all. And I got angry. I took a pound note out of my wallet, slammed it on the desk, join me. And that was Bernard, Professor Bernard Carr. We became very good friends afterwards. Also, because the other society we joined together was the Psychic Research Society. We went ghost hunting together. Really beautiful, really good fun. Because, and he was also a theoretical physicist as well. So, you know, we did lots of stuff together, knew each other really well. And I went off to become a monk with one of the great teachers, Ajahn Chah. And I don't know if I told you why I chose Ajahn Chah to be my teacher. It was because I was an English monk. And Chah is a Thai word for tea. So it's sort of fat, you know, an English monk with a teacher whose name meant tea. Anyway. That's not true, by the way, it's exaggeration. But that later on, you know, we'd meet one another, but later on I found out that Bernard became a very close disciple of Stephen Hawking. So much so that Bernard was featured in that film, you know, The Theory of Everything, the life of Stephen Hawking. And even when I was, the last time I was at Cambridge, they're having dinners, and Bernard said, I have to go quickly, I've got to go and see Stephen.
So, very close.
So there we go. Ajahn Brahm, disciple of one of the great meditation masters,
Bernard,
one of the great disciples of the greatest physicist. And we came together at this conference. How can we take Buddhism and theoretical physics and put it together? And he said, there should be no problem. The primacy of the mind. And he told me one of these great experiments which he attended from one of his friends at the Psychic Research Society in London. It was a levitating flower pot. Have you heard that story? Because they arranged this experiment at Imperial College. And there was a very well-known physicist. There was also a member of the Psychic Research Society in London. And he claimed he was going to levitate a flower pot. And he had enough cred in the scientific community to get all these professors and researchers, quite well known, to come to the lecture hall to witness a demonstration on levitation. With cameras and videos, seeing this so there could be no funny business. And these trained observers who were professors and lecturers got seated down, and the experimenter, the presenter, came into the lecture theatre. You may have been in these old science lecture theatres. They have a big table in front, and they have the benches going up so the students could see and take notes. He came in carrying a flower pot, and he put it on the laboratory bench. No wires, very easy to see that. And he announced that he had the videos going, announced that he was going to demonstrate levitation. But he said he did require the assistance of the audience. He asked all his crusty old professors to start chanting Om. And that was an amazing achievement, that all these old lecturers were sitting there going, Om, 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 Om. And as they were chanting Om, the flower pot lifted above the bench. It was filmed, it was video. But afterwards, they asked many of those professors, even though it's on video, and they said, it didn't rise above the table, it didn't rise at all. It was always on the table, all the time. Even though they showed it on video. No, it was always on the table. Because it was not a demonstration of levitation. It was a demonstration of perception. Because the truth of the matter was, there was this huge, powerful electromagnet under the bench. And when he turned on the current, it would always make a hum and he would be busted. They'd find out he was up to something. So the Om was to mask the hum of the high amperage currents. But that wasn't the point. The point was, these were very well-trained scientists who were seeing something which just couldn't happen. And so it didn't happen. They cut it off. Their perception. It never even registered in their consciousness. That was the purpose of the experiment. And that was an amazing little test that in laboratory conditions in a well-known London university with great professors looking on. It just shows us how the mind controls perception. We see only what we want to see. We block out what is there, but which challenges us too deeply. And I love it when scientists get into this and they challenge stuff. So, good old Bernard, great friend, and because of him, I did, it's another movie I say I watched, was The Theory of Everything. And the one thing I noted there was when Stephen Hawking started saying, and I heard this before, but I checked it with Bernard, Professor Bernard Carr. He's a Buddhist, still is a Buddhist. I think he was the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London. and he was also a close disciple of Stephen Hawking. He retired last year, but now he's Professor Emeritus of Queen Mary College in London University. Because he's a Buddhist, at psychic research, he's a disciple of Stephen Hawking. He's got cred. So he's a great one to invite to give a talk. And he knows that, so actually it's interesting. And also that he was saying that Stephen Hawking, he was the person responsible for the Big Bang idea. And now he said, no, the Big Bang did not start the universe. He now understands a universe without boundaries. And that is Buddhism. Beginningless time. And to understand what it means, I like bringing in some of my science training now. Flat Earth. I told you earlier that, because I'm doing a debate with Russell Brand next month. Again, that's baldy guy where no muck's gone before. And in debates, because I remember they had the Flat Earth Society in Cambridge, and to actually to become a member of that, you had to present a paper and argue it that the Earth is flat. The point was, the good person could argue anything. If you remember, if you could become a member of the Flat Earth Society and you could argue the Earth is flat, which is obviously wrong, then you can join the cabinet of the government and convince the people anything. So, Flat Earth. Many intelligent people believed the Earth was flat 500, 600, 700 years ago. And now, of course, we all know that's wrong. You can see it is a sphere, a bit fat in the middle, like me. It's elongated. The equator is actually wider radius than the distance between the poles. And we all know it's not flat, it's round. You go, it's a limited area. There's only so much area on planet Earth, but there's no edges to it. Whichever way you go, you'll come back to where you started. So now we go to space, the universe. And I often thought, as a young student going in the bus, has the universe, has space got an edge to it? If there was an edge to space, what actually would it be? Would it be like a wall saying no trespassing? You know, it's very difficult to have a wall or a fence. Even in Australia, in our retreat centre where, you know, your daughter spent 3 months, you know, we try to keep out riffraff. So, you know, we put a sign up. We didn't put a sign up, no riffraff. We said, trespassers will be prosecuted. And that never worked. Because Australians aren't afraid of that. So we changed the sign to, you've seen it, trespassers will be converted. That worked. So if you want to put a sign up on the Buddhist Society, keep burglars out, put up there, beware of conversion. You know, that somebody took a picture of that sign and it won the Sign of the Month award in the Daily Telegraph. Yes, it did. They sent the article back. But, where was I going on this? The end of the universe. You know, there's no sign of the end of the universe. It didn't make any sense. How could there be an edge to this universe? Walls?
You were talking about walls.
Yeah, walls. It can't be a wall in the end of the universe. There can't be an edge to it. So what does it work? Is it infinite? And there was a very, very, I think, Odler's proof. I think that's what it was called. A very simple proof. This universe cannot be infinite. It's illogical. It's infinite. But I remember at the lecture about the universe, the lecturer actually brought in, I think it was Stephen Hawking's teacher. I forgot what his name was now, but anyway, he brought in a football,
and he said the universe is like the football, only extended in another dimension. It is curved. It is a finite amount of volume, but no edges to it. Whichever direction you go, theoretically, you come back to where you started. It's an expanding universe, but no edges to it. Like a balloon which is being blown up, but going round and round. A universe, limited space, but no boundaries, no edges to it, no beginning, and no end. That is standard, accepted by every scientist. So now we go to the next level. Time. Why is it we think if you go back far enough in time, you'll come to an edge? Right? Flat Earth. If you sail your ship far enough, you'll fall off the edge. If you go forward enough in time, again you come to the end of time, where you fall off. That is not the view of people like Stephen Hawking, nor the Buddha. We call that flat time believers, like flat Earth. Why should time be flat when everything else is curved? Curved time. No beginning, no end. Solution. Unfortunately, that doesn't give a conception of a God anything to do. No creator, no dissolver, no end. Beginningless time. Welcome to the teachings of the Buddha from theoretical physics. I love it when you get things like that coming up. Stretches people's imagination and comes much closer to the truth of things. An understanding of this Dhamma which we have is actually brilliant. And also, so you get this in physics conferences as well, which is lovely to do. Buddhism and science. Get it all together. But even more than that, that every time, actually, I'm trying to get this really involved. Going to, every time I go to Toronto, I manage to get myself to the university where they give a course on Buddhism, medicine, and psychology. Now, I think you all know how Buddhism and psychology interact with the work of people like Kabat-Zinn, you know, and mindfulness. But with medicine as well. And that's huge. But first of all, with psychology, and I think I told us at one of the courses over there, one of the nights of the lecture, at the retreat, sorry. There's a group over in Australia, did I say this last year, about ASSETS, Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. Because this is actually quite moving for me, to be able to talk about this group. Because these are people, refugees, who come into Australia, as they come into UK. They've gone through hell, and worse. These are people who have been tortured, multiple rapes, beaten, and managed to survive. They come to a country like UK or to Australia. Their bodies are free. But their minds are still in those dungeons and torture chambers throughout the world, going through some of the stories they say is just absolutely gross. And to this day, I can't understand how a human being can do that to another human being. But it happens. It's probably happening right now, somewhere. The trouble is, they're in a country where their bodies are free. That mind hasn't gone past, can't go past the incredible trauma of their past. So, they use some of my teachings to great effect, which is why they invited me
to their group just to say thank you. And the story which really helped them, Dhamma, which helps one of the most intractable problems of trauma in our world, was a simple story adapted of opening the door of your heart. It's the title of my first book. And that came from my father. Came from Liverpool. He died when I was 16. Simple man. But he was the fellow who took me aside in Churchfield Road, Acton. You know, we lived just around the corner from there. In his beat up car, and gave me some advice, which thank you so much for this. He said, son, I was about 13 years of age at the time, son, wherever you go in your life, whatever happens to you, please always remember the door of my house will always be open to you. That was important, but I was a 13-year-old male. I just did not understand it, but I knew it was important. And I kept it, you know, in my memory bank somewhere until the time came that I was emotionally more mature and developed and had the time to understand what he had said. And that was when I was a young monk in Thailand. I thought about that. What did he mean? Because his house was a council flat. I often say that he would never worry about locking the door. He was actually quite hopeful that a burglar might come in, take pity on us and leave something. That was the old joke, but you know, it's not far from the truth. And it wasn't his house he was opening up, it was his heart. He was giving me unconditional love, compassion, but in a way which I could understand much better. Son, whatever you did in your life, however you turned out, if I was proud of you or ashamed of you, if you were notorious or a celebrity, either way, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're my son, and that's enough. And that meant so much to me. He was dead at that time, that your father gave me such unconditional acceptance and love. And it never meant that I had a blank check to do whatever I wanted. It inspired me, uplifted me so much, I had to do even better to merit and live up to the trust which my father gave me. It was the opposite of what many people expect. Oh, you can do anything now. Your father will always bear you out, no matter what trouble you get into. It's no, wow, this was something immense. You know, sometimes I say that to the couples, especially when I give them a marriage blessing. Can you actually say that to your wife, your husband? Darling, whatever you do in your life, whatever you do, I'll always love you. And I mean that. The door of my heart's always going to be open to you. They'd never take advantage of that. It's an incredible lifting up of trust. Something so amazing. But if it's sincere, your partner can never harm you, hurt you. Someone who really trusts you 100% and is vulnerable to being abused, but you can never do that. So, I was teaching that so often that I also noticed a great extension of that simile, which I taught to victims of abuse. And it works. That's an amazing thing, that this is used in these societies who treat sometimes the untreatable people. When they feel safe, secure at their time, they sit down, close their eyes, and they imagine a little heart in their chest. So I say, not a real heart, you know, if you're an anatomist or a surgeon. That is so complicated. Tubes coming here, tubes coming there. But the Valentine's Day heart, you know, pointed at the bottom with a little crevice in the top. That sort of heart. You imagine that, and imagine that's got two doors to it. And it opens up. And there, standing inside your heart, is that part of you which you can accept and live with. The acceptable part of you. And outside, you look down on the ground, is those parts of you which were rejected a long time ago because they were abused, hurt, beaten, even raped. They're outside, frightened, terrified, suffering, alone. But they're part of your history. They happened. And then you imagine this staircase going down. A connection between the two parts of you. And then, you at the top, the one you've already let into your heart, the good part of you, the stuff that you can accept and enjoy and be proud of even, that invites the other half to come up. Come up. You're part of me, you're my history. And you imagine these terrified little beings, this little girl who's cruelly abused and raped, the boy who's beaten so badly, thought he would die. You encourage them, bring them up as they climb up those stairs and meet the other part of you at the top as you embrace. Come in. You're part of me. I will never try and reject you and push you away ever again. With that embracing, that coming in, there's a huge catharsis. Because the problem always was rejection, pushing out, pushing away. It's a tough thing to do, to embrace that, to bring it in when it's so painful. But when it comes in, the pain is gone. The catharsis heals. And when I went there years ago, I never realized they still do that regularly. It's one of the best treatments. Because one of my friends, his wife, works as a volunteer. He said, oh yeah, they still do it there. The opening the door of your heart method, because it works. As it can work for you. Compassion is that powerful. And it's wonderful you can take this Dhamma into such an immense world. And actually, it's not what I thought I'd sign up for. I thought I'd just be a little monk meditating by myself in a cave somewhere, and that would be it. But if you understand these teachings, and they can help so much, why not share it around? And even in medicine, it's not just no stress. There's all sorts of other things which you understand when you are a meditator. You're mindful, you're aware, you're kind, and you can see what goes on in the human body. And so, this little story of how amazing things can happen to people's health. There was even a TED talk which somebody told me about, which I downloaded and looked at. Some very smart psychologist was wondering why it is that people with stressful jobs, some people get cardiac disease, other people don't. Why? They have the same amount of work and problems and troubles to deal with, but some cardiac health is fine. And it was all to do with, again, attitude. The way you looked at the stress, it was the negativity, the anger, why me? I don't want to do this. That was the problem. And the solution was, and the last little anecdote story, which fits the title of the talk, was an experience I had with Ajahn Chah in Thailand. He had built his monastery, the big hall in the monastery. And if ever you've been there, he actually raised it above the level of the forest. With a man, I'll call it a man-made mound of earth, it was a monk-made mound of earth. But there was lots of earth left over. And one day after our breakfast, our one meal of the day, he asked us, I want you to move that earth into the place he pointed it out, into the forest. Now that meant 3 days of hard labor, from about 9:30 in the morning to about 9 o'clock at night, you know, using hurricane lanterns to see our way. One Pepsi or Coca-Cola maybe, just to rehydrate. Pushing barrows of earth, shoveling it in through the hot, steaming jungles of Thailand. If you think it's hot today, that's nothing, nothing compared to how hot it was in the steaming jungles. Moreover, you have been bitten by mosquitoes all the time. Much more than the Thais, because the mosquitoes had been used to Thai food. They wanted to try Western food for a change. So we were bitten to death by these, well, not really to death, but, you know, almost, by these mosquitoes, shoveling earth. But this was for your teacher. He gave you so much wisdom and kindness. You'd do anything for your teacher. 3 days were over, and I was exhausted. I was tired. You were dirty. You didn't really have much time to wash your robes. Smelly, tired. But we're finished. That night, I had a deep sleep, exhausted, thinking the following morning, wash some robes, you know, do some meditation, get back to normal again. And that night, Ajahn Chah went off to another monastery. And the second monk, Ajahn Liam, after our one meal of the day, he said, you've moved it to the wrong place. Move it to another place over there. He had a point. It wasn't the wrong place. It didn't actually fit there. So 3 more days of hard work in the jungles of Thailand, bitten by mosquitoes, dirty, smelly, tired. But we finished it. 6 days. We finally moved the earth. Following day, oh, I'm just going to do nothing. I'm not even going to wash my robes. I'm just too tired. I'm going to meditate or whatever. But that night, guess what happened? Ajahn Chah came back. This is absolutely true story. Can't exaggerate this. It happened. And he said, what did you put the earth over there for? I told you to put this other place. Move it! Another 3 days of hard work loomed in front of me. Smelly, no rest, on one meal a day. That is when I lost my faith. That is when I wondered, what have I signed up for? I never signed up to be a labourer. I never signed up to work like a dog. I signed up to meditate and understand the Dharma and become enlightened. Not to labour pushing wheelbarrows all day. What's that got to do with meditation and Buddhism? I was upset. I was angry. I was swearing. In English, so the Thai monks couldn't understand. But they could understand. It's body language. And that was when one of the Thai monks, I do not know who it was, but whoever it was, thank you teacher, he came up and gave me this wonderful teaching, which again has helped me and helped so many others throughout our lives. He said, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And I got it straight away. I stopped complaining and thinking about it. The wheelbarrow was much lighter to push and had a lot of fun. You know what we used to do? Playing around as monks. You know, if another monk was a bit naughty, I'd shovel the earth. I'm terribly sorry I missed. It's gone all over you. I'm sorry. Have races. Have fun. And the 3 days went very quickly. And thank goodness the earth was in the right place. So that was it. But I've used that so often in my life. Thinking about it is easy. So thinking about it is the hard part. Thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it is easy. There's many who look at my program and say, wow, that's a grueling program. It's not a grueling problem. It is if you think about it. Doing it is so easy. Are you working or doing exams?
Doing exams.
Exams are easy. Don't think about it, just do it. It's absolutely true, you know. Dying is easy. Thinking about it is a problem. Building a nun's monastery is easy. I've done quite a few already. Thinking about it is the hard part. So often that's the case. Little pieces of wisdom like that, I realise monastic life, or life in general, is not what you expect. It's always a series of unexpected, unplanned events. So I don't know what you signed up for, I thought the best to see it. Doing life is easy, but thinking about it is the hard part. So you signed up for life, don't think about it. This talk this evening was sponsored by Nike. Just do it. Okay. So, now's a good time for questions and answers, and those people who have bladder problems can go off to the toilet. Do letting go. So, any comments or questions about what did I sign up for? Little nice pieces of wisdom, which actually makes sense. And actually you can use. Not intellectual. See ya. No questions. I did tell this story last year, I'm sure. This is from the Buddhist Theravada Sutras. I think it's from the Chuddhakamalabandha Sutra. Where a man came and asked the Buddha, why is it that some people are wealthy and some people are just poor? You work very hard and still you find it hard to pay the bills. It can't be the effort which you put into this life. It must be something from the previous life. And the Buddha actually said, yeah, the reason why some people find it very easy to make money is because of some type of karma we did in the past life. And then with such a good answer, he asked a second question. Why is it that some people are beautiful while other people are just ugly? Doesn't matter how many face makeovers you have, you're always ugly. What did you do in your past life? Now you may have noticed, when I mention the word beautiful, I look to the floor. And I also look to the floor when I mention the word ugly. Because when I told this story once in Singapore, I just happened by chance to be looking at one lady when I said the word ugly, and she complained. Why did you say the word ugly when you were looking at me? So you've got to be very careful, especially even when I say the word beautiful, I have to look at the floor again so people don't misunderstand. I thought even if I just looked at a guy instead of a girl when I said the word beautiful, I'd be fine, but not these days. So he gave a good answer, but the best part of this question, the reason why I'm saying it, is that he also said, why is it that some people are intelligent? You don't have to work hard for your exams, you just keep going there and you pass, you get the first class honours or whatever it is. Why is some people just intelligent and other people are stupid? No matter how much homework, studies, extra tuition you get, you still can't pass. Why? You know what the answer was? The Buddha said, the cause for stupidity in your next life is not asking questions in this life. Any questions? Yeah, you always get questions that way, it's amazing. Yeah, go on.
In Myanmar, in Burma, people who are signed up Buddhists are persecuting Muslims.
Yeah.
How should we react to that?
How should we react to that? Number one, by helping those people who have been persecuted. First of all, there are people who are poor, haven't got enough to eat, living in tents, just surviving only just with their kids. So first of all, it don't matter why, how, who's to blame, there are people there who need help. So already, just before I even came here, I managed to get $6,000 together, not much, but we managed to find out how we can send it to Bangladesh, where many of those displaced people are, to give it to them. It's only a little bit, but at least we're doing something. So don't blame anybody, just that goes round and round. There are people who need help. And I don't care if it's Christian, Buddhist, Muslims, however. Our job, our responsibility as human beings, even moreover if you're Buddhist, may all sentient beings be happy and well. Do a collection. It's actually, you don't have to do it through the Buddhist Society over here. There's many places you can do donations for the Rohingyas who are displaced. Do it. And I managed to get my little exercise in giving on YouTube, just like to encourage other people to do the same. Do it now. And number two is also, why does that happen? It's not Buddhism, it's nationalism. It is fear. As one of the other people to invite over here is one of my monks, Ajahn Brahmani, who gave a little 15-minute piece. These people think of themselves as Buddhists. And they should never think of themselves as Buddhists, but Buddhist practitioners. If you're a Buddhist, you know, you make a personality of this, and you feel threatened and challenged. But remember Buddhist practice. What does a Buddhist actually do? Just because you're a member of the Buddhist Society doesn't mean you're a Buddhist. It's what you do. That's what makes you a Buddhist. So anyone who is cruel, burns down other people's property or kills. It's very hard to reconcile those as Buddhist practitioners. They may call themselves a Buddhist, just like my father had to put on the form, C of E, Church of England. He was an atheist. You know, he never went to church. But he still put down their C of E. Nominal Buddhists. Be very careful with mobile phones, because if they go off during a talk, they get reincarnated in the next existence as a parking meter. Which is the lowest form of life, depending on the truth. But anyway, so you can't say they're Buddhist. And any Buddhist monk, so-called monk, who advocates violence, especially who kills, you see them killing or telling other people to kill, they, by that very act, lose their status of being a monk. It's no questions asked. Killing is actually a paratika offence. You're no longer a monk. You can't be a monk. You don't fit the meaning of a monk. So why is that happening? Because a lot of Buddhists in Myanmar feel afraid. They feel that the religion is being threatened. They have some legitimate concerns. But that doesn't excuse what they have done. So to solve problems, just like what happened in Northern Ireland some years ago, you don't just blame people, you blame acts. Bad acts, bad speech, wherever it comes from. And that is how you solve conflict. It's from the Arana Vibhanga Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sutra on Non-Conflict. Please do not criticize Aung San Suu Kyi, Muslim terrorists, or whoever. Criticize actions, or lack of action, wrong speech, lying, fear. There's going to be a lot of parking meters in this problem. So that is the reaction. And the other thing, please do not respect Buddhist monks and nuns too much, that you never question them. That's the other thing in Burma and in Thailand, and it happened with some Tibetan monks as well. What they were doing was obviously inappropriate. But I know in Thailand, because I've lived there for many years, lay Buddhists sometimes say, if you criticize a monk, that's bad karma, you'll go to hell. Fear. It reminds me of what was happening in the Catholic Church. If you criticize a Catholic priest when you know he's in the paedophile, no, don't go there. And that attitude caused so much harm to many, many children. And that harm is still being felt now. So, please, Buddhist monks and nuns should never be above criticism. The poet, even in Australia, now I'm not sure what it's like over here, because of what happened, even Buddhist monks, I have to have a working with children card. Even though I don't focus on children, but if I don't have, if I haven't gone through that pre-vetting procedure where they check, you know, what you've done, then if there was a kid over here under 16 years of age, even sitting in the back, this was in Australia, the Buddhist Society would be fined quite a lot of money, $20,000-$30,000, and I would also be fined. Wonderful. Because we do need to address those problems. If you see any monk doing something inappropriate, illegal, please, no, with evidence, not with ill will, to protect Buddhism, please bring it up. Yes?
It's just out of curiosity. After all these years, you are a monk.
Yeah.
I guess from the beginning you have to reject many things in life.
Yeah.
You can. If there is something today that you could incorporate in your present life, if there is, perhaps there is nothing, what would be?
I have enough things to do already. You don't want to incorporate anything else. I focus sometimes that one thing at a time. I usually do more than one thing at a time. But there are some things you would like to be able to improve upon. Now, one thing is the harmony between all the different Buddhist traditions. And you've gone a long way towards that. You know, finding that the Mahayana teachings, we have the same core teachings. They're called the Agamas. Ours is the Sutras, the Tipitaka. And you actually learn your Pali, learn your Sanskrit, and they're almost identical. So that means that, you know, we're a tradition which was divided by history. Look, different on the outside because our robes and our chanting. But you get to know, especially Korean monks. They come to our monastery, they join in everything. I go to their monastery. You're totally accepted. You're one of them. It's wonderful that that happens. The boundaries between Mahayana and Theravada are coming down. Because there's no logical reason why they should be there in the first place. It was just a historical anomaly. Separated with no means of communication. Now mass communication moving around, we're the same. And even with the Vajrayana tradition. So many of the Vajrayana Western monks and nuns, they practice Theravada meditation. Well, it's not Theravada meditation, it's meditation, that's all. So what's the big difference? So it's wonderful that we can break down those barriers between our different traditions. There's only one Buddha anyway. Our hearts are the same, kindness, compassion. And then break down barriers between other religions as well. Between Muslims. There's a big problem there. We're afraid. Can't we talk to one another and find out what's going on? Once there was two men in a kitchen and they had one orange and both of them wanted it. One said, you had the last one, so this time it's my turn. There's only one orange there. The other one said, but you had the last two, so I should have this one as well. So they argued over the orange. And they eventually ended up compromising. They cut the orange in half. One guy peeled his orange through the peel in the rubbish bin and ate the flesh of the orange. The other one peeled his orange through the flesh in the waste bin because he needed the peel to make a cake. If they had only asked why they wanted an orange, they would have had an argument and both would have had twice as much. That's such a common thing in conflict resolution. So, the people in Rakhine State, in the north of Burma, what do you want? Muslims, what do you want? Find that first of all, and then we can maybe find some reconciliation, some peace. A lot of time people say they want a fair playing field. Now, in Australia, we're having same-sex marriage referendum, or referendum, which is not binding anyway. Absolute idiocy. But out of that has come up, you know, because it's not binding anyway. The polls know what the answer is going to be. It's just delaying tactics. But many of the people who are trying to stop same-sex marriage, they're saying, oh, it's an attack on the freedom of religion. You know what they're saying now? No. It's freedom from religion. Which is an interesting, instead of freedom of religion, freedom from religion. Because religion's got such a bad rap these days. People want to be free of it. It's just the same as, you know, the two types of freedom. Freedom of desire, which is doing what you want when you want it. That's our modern world. Internet, you can press a button and soon you get whatever delivered to you and a drone by Amazon. You don't even need to go to the supermarket for it. Just delivered. In a short while, monks will not need dana. All we do is get on the internet, press what we want for lunch, it'll be delivered by a drone. You won't need to even cook anything. Is that the way? Sometimes one of the things as Buddhist monks, you know, we need a driver to take us to place to place. We're not allowed to have a driving license. Google cars, we won't need anyone to drive us anymore. Offering things to people, you can get a robot to do that. I was telling already, in Japan, there's not enough monks to do ceremonies. You guessed it, they have robot monks. Their quality is perfect. All of you Sri Lankans over here, how hard is it to get some priests to go and do some paritta chanting for you? You won't need that soon. You get a robot and they do the paritta chanting so easily, so perfectly, that you won't need to go and take a car to pick them up from the temple. So, okay, you go. I'm sorry, I don't know if it's you, but anyway. I don't think it was. But freedom of desire is what our world leaders guarantee us. Whatever you want, wherever you want, whatever you want to do. But that's not the right freedom. Freedom from desire. So you don't need anything. You don't want anything. The two types of freedom. And to understand that, a deep little teaching. Sometimes people, they sign up to become a Buddhist because they want to get Nibbana. Have you any idea what Nibbana is? Even today people argue what it is. So it's like getting on a bus not knowing what the destination is. How dumb is that? So you know what happened? When I was at school, I was interested, I was sincere about religion. So I remember going up to the chaplain at the school. It was a Latimer school I went to. They had a chaplain, it was an Anglican school. And I asked him, in sincerity, now what is this God? What is God? And his answer was, it was the ineffable, the beginning and end of all things, the ground of all being, the Alpha to Omega, the indescribable. And to me that was just, can I say the word bullshit? It made no sense to me at all. You know, if you know what he's talking about, it should be explain it to me. And so it never made any sense. But later on, when I became a Buddhist, I remember, I'm not sure if it was here in some other Buddhist talk somewhere. I could have been in the old Thai temple in Ishii. And I asked the monk, what's Nibbana? You know what he said? It's ineffable, indescribable, the ground of all being. And I said, I've heard that before somewhere. Another person who didn't know. But then, I got the great answer. Something simple, which you can understand, and which gives a lot of meaning to what we're doing. The five children playing the wishing game. You heard that story before? So the five children playing the wishing game. The wishing game, the rules go like this. You have a wish, and the child who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. Simple. So the first child put his hand up and said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a new Nintendo. You like computer games. Fair enough. The second child had more time to think, and he said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game store, a shop, because then I can get another computer game whenever I want one, not just one. Obviously that was superior, having a shop, so you can have many Nintendo games. The third child had more time to think, was much smarter, and he said, no, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $10 billion US. More money than anyone could ever spend, unless you're in government. And with $10 billion US, I'll buy my own computer game shop. But the problem is, my mother would never let me play computer games until I finish my homework. So then I'll buy my own school. And if I own the school and pay all the teachers, I won't need to do any homework. Because if they make me do homework and don't give me top marks, I'll sack the lot. And once I've graduated from my own school, then I'll buy my own university like Mr. Trump did. Actually, did you hear the latest news about the assassination attempt against the President of the United States? Have you heard that yet? No, really? No, at one of his meetings, an assassin stood up and pointed a gun at the President. And one of the security guards shouted out, Donald Duck! And the assassin burst out laughing, couldn't pull the trigger, got arrested. That never happened, it's only a joke. But anyway, back to the real stuff. Where was I? Oh, the $10 billion US. So I buy my own university, so I don't need to ever go to school. I can play computer games all the time. With $10 billion US, whenever you think of something else, you can buy it. So beat that. There's two children left, remember? And the fourth girl, she was really smart. Said, I can beat that. If I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish, three wishes. For my first wish, I'll have $10 billion. No, first wish, I'll have a computer game shop. Second wish, I'll have $10 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. So the fourth child had an infinity of wishes granted. The fifth child would win the wishing game. Managed to conceive of a wish which clearly surpassed an infinity of wishes granted whenever you want something. The fifth child said, if I had a wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. That was a Buddha, that was enlightenment, the end of desire and craving. So content, you don't need wishes anymore, the end of desire. The fourth child, infinity of wishes, was the people who want power, the freedom of desire to get whatever you want, whenever you want it. The fifth child, freedom from desire, don't need anything, happy, whatever happens. That's called enlightenment. Nibbana. Now you understand what it means. It's so easy to understand. And it also explains why people do become presidents of the United States. Who would ever want that job? Had lots of money. That was like the third child. $10 billion US. But now he wants the freedom. Every wish he wants to get. The infinite wishes, the freedom of desire, fantasy, delusion. And the freedom from desire, that's what your daughter wants. No desire. Free! That. Understand? Yes. So it makes it very easy to. Any other questions before we finish up? How's the time going? Are we over time, out of time? In time? My time is moving on. But you've got a question over there. Yes.
Yeah, I have been using different Buddhist models to help the technology industry. So this is in to synergy.
Yeah.
And I translate these models to help software engineering teams.
Yeah.
And management get along plus deliver. Now, I've copped a lot of flack from people saying that it's personal practice and that I shouldn't be taking it into the corporate arena to help large corporations become more productive. Not the way I see it, but I wondered if you have any comments on that.
Indeed. We are currently, one of the reasons I'm here, is raising funds to build a monastery for women in England, bhikkhunis, with equity, with fairness. If there weren't any rich guys and girls in England, we'd be stuffed. So, it's wonderful if communities or businesses, you know, can make a profit to employ more people. And to use those funds in a wise way. Early Buddhism depended on people like Anathapindika, King Bimbisara. Without those, the Buddha would not have had a monastery with which, you know, to spread the Dharma. It is a synergy. But as long as those profits are made, not at the expense of people's well-being and happiness. And that is one of the things which is important in corporations. Old word, sustainability. You know, you're one of the former members of your committee, Colin Ash. And he came along to one conference once, and he said, what is the economic benefit of monks and nuns? Because he said, we don't produce anything. We're not engineers or teachers. Well, we are teachers in a way. But what is the productive benefit of monks and nuns in society? And he said, because monks and nuns set an example of frugality, and but most importantly, honesty and trust. Because he described something he called transaction costs. That is, when you order something from a supplier, and you can't trust that the goods they deliver is what's specified in the brochure, and they will arrive on time. People lie to get the deal. And that a company has to take into account transaction costs. That, you know, they promise they will deliver, they promise they have a certain quality, and you know sometimes it's not. And also, selling your product. So often, you sell the product and the buyer, the purchaser, doesn't pay on time. That's also a transaction cost. Just because of lack of trust and honesty, there is a big hit onto the GNP. And you can actually measure that as an economist. So he was saying, the presence of Buddhist monks and nuns, honest people, in society actually encourages more honesty and actually improves the economic performance of the society. And that was coming from Colin Ash, and I thought, wow, now how many other areas of society where we encourage trust and honesty that things will improve? And I quoted, I have the article, but over in Australia, there was an engineering firm, I think in Birmingham, called Farrelly and Sons. It was a building maintenance company who won an award, the Best Company of the Year award, in an engineering groups. And in 1 year, they had trebled their turnover, doubled their profits, with a very simple but radical strategy. They banned all overtime. Fascinating. Because when they banned overtime, it meant all of their workers could go home on time, spend time with their family, rest. And when they went to work the following morning, they were rested, really ready to work, without taking to work all their family problems with their children, with their partners, which many people do in today's world. By the time they go to work, they've got other stuff, really important stuff they have to think about and worry about. Not only that, was the staff turnover went almost to zero, because the company was actually looking after their staff. No homework, no overtime. When you leave, you leave. Don't take any work with you. Working for a company like that was amazing. So staff turnover went to zero. And they were saying, every time you change a key person in the staff, it takes about 6 months on average to get back to where you were, for that new staff to know the job, know the people, know all the contacts. That's 6 months of unproductive behavior. So they said, and people really wanted to work for that company because they were working for them. So they said, that was a wonderful example of something of care, trust, looking after the people who work for you, was highly profitable. So people who these days think that the only way to get a profit is to screw your staff, screw everybody else, that is not wise business practice. You're going to go under. Look after the staff, look after your clients, get their relationship going, trust. Not fast profits, but long-term sustainable profits. Everybody working in that company feels good about that company with which they work. You've seen the way I'm not a CEO, I'm a CEM, Chief Executive Muck. And you see the way I run my monastery, with kindness, trust, so people want to work for you, with you, rather than telling people off.
Do you think there is a risk of misinterpretation or misappropriation of Buddha's teaching in a business environment?
No, go for it. Why not?
I think people are getting so desperate anyway for sustainable innovation, sustainable success, that they're getting open to these ideas.
Not only that, but this is personal experience, because, you know, I am a bit of a celebrity. You get invited into major conferences, you know, with politicians, prime ministers, presidents, kings, queens. These are the people who actually take you aside and say, help. Literally, help. Your prime ministers and presidents go into that job wanting to make a positive difference. They're not crooks when they start. A lot of times they're crooks when they come out. But when they start, they come with really high motivations. But they just don't know what to do. They're at their wit's end. Help! And they've tried everything. What they haven't tried is actually Dhamma, Buddhism. And you know, there's a huge resource there of like thinking outside the box. So why don't we do this? So I feel a bit sort of Buddhist leaders would be negligent, not actually taking this out there.
Well, there's quite a community here in London in the technology industry
that are
starting to translate research.
Absolutely, yeah. Here you go, Chade Meng, Google, he invited me over there. You know, just search within, his bestseller. I also got invited to Facebook headquarters as well. You know, the only difference between Google and Facebook headquarters in Silicon Valley, in Google headquarters they give you a bicycle to go everywhere. Facebook is much more modern. They give you a skateboard. They got all these executives skateboarding around the place. And they offer me one. And I was, no way, I'm not going to try that. I'm so heavy that, you know, you break it. But anyway, that's what they do over there. But, yeah, Buddhism is, you know, is accepted as being something which is a resource, hasn't been tried. So anyway, I think that's going to happen in the future. Okay, people are leaving, so you've got to go back. It's a working day, but I've got a job to do tomorrow as well, teaching another retreat. So, we'd like to wrap up.
Thank you so much. Wonderful talk.
Thank you.